And welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you could join us. We are overdue on Brussels Sprouts for an update on the war in Ukraine. The mood in and around the war is dark and generally pessimistic. Russia's making slow and steady gains in some areas, even if at a heavy cost for Moscow. And aid continues to be stalled in the U.S. Congress, which is significantly contributing to Kyiv's challenges. The head of the U.S. European Command has warned that Ukraine may be in danger of losing the war unless it soon receives additional ammunition from Washington. And the lack of air defense is allowing Russian missile attacks to continue to destroy critical infrastructure and cause civilian casualties as Kyiv is being forced to choose which cities it can defend, given the shortages. This predicament stands in sharp contrast to what transpired in Israel over the past weekend, where the United States and other countries were willing to help Israel defend its skies, a contrast that has generated disappointment and frustration in Ukraine. There may be some bright spots, however. The Congress appears closer to passing the Ukraine aid than it has been, and Kyiv recently made the decision to lower its draft age from 27 to 25, which could help alleviate some of its manpower issues. So to talk about all of these developments and more, we're really happy to have back on the podcast with us Mike Kaufman. Mike, welcome back.
Good to see you, and thanks for having me back on the podcast.
Mike, of course, is senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he focuses on the Russian military and Eurasian security issues. Okay. Maybe, Mike, since it's been a little while on Brussels Sprouts, where we've kind of provided a lay of the land, give us your sense of where we are in the war. Where are we in the arc of this story?
Sure. So I think it's fair to say that the overall situation at the front line isn't terrible, but it's been trending negatively since the Ukraine offensive culminated last fall, probably since around October. And the Ukrainian military has been working actively to try to stabilize the front. I'd say that Russian gains have slowed down significantly since they seized the pocket around Avdiivka, but nonetheless, Russian forces have been slowly creeping, making incremental gains a couple kilometers here and there. And so a big question that hangs right now is, will Ukraine be able to stabilize the front line in the coming months? Ukraine is suffering from a couple of interrelated problems. The most important one is manpower and a deficit of manpower. Hopefully, the recently passed mobilization laws, there are multiple of them, and the funding being provided by the U.S. will help address that in the coming months. Fortifications is another issue. Ukraine's been actively building three lines of defense. You know, it's trying to complete this work as fast as possible, essentially preparing secondary positions to entrench their lines. The third one everybody's, I think, very well aware of, which is the deficit of artillery and munition, one area where Ukraine depends on the United States, on Western countries, and not just artillery ammunition, air defense interceptors, and material support we've been delivering on a monthly basis since fairly early on into this war. So that hinges partly on a supplemental passing, which, you know, I'm a bit optimistic that, you know, we're just having this discussion on Thursday. I'm hoping that it will pass on Saturday night. Also on European efforts, you know, there's a Czech initiative, there's an Estonian initiative, there's a whole bunch of European initiatives out there. It's not just the United States. And there are other issues, but I want to focus on these three. So on the Russian side of the equation, yes, the Russian military is materially advantaged this year, but that advantage isn't decisive. Russia still has significant force quality issues, so they can't employ their force on a large scale. That's why they haven't been able to attain large breakthroughs, and they haven't been able to sustain momentum after a breakthrough. So it results in incremental gains instead of sort of like a big shifts in the line that are hard to stop. The second issue is that the Russian military, on the one hand, has been able to stabilize the force, address the manpower issues, but is eating through a lot of the equipment. And most of that equipment is coming out of storage from Soviet stocks, and they are going to end up having equipment issues next year. There are already signs that they're having to pull out older and older equipment this year. And all of that adds up to the fact that Russia has basically a window of opportunity this year. And if they don't obtain decisive advantage, which can be denied to them, right? Like things are generally not inevitable in war. I want to make clear. Some things are harder to achieve than others. But if Russia does not obtain a decisive advantage, and if they don't generate momentum behind their offensive operations this year, and I think there will be multiple Russian offensives this year, then their overall advantage begins to decline in 2025. Ukraine digs in. The Ukrainian forces are stabilized. Our and European production of ammo and key components goes up rather than down by the end of this year. Actually, we look a lot better materially towards the end of this year than we do right now. And then the odds of Russia attaining some of their objectives in this war actually really begin to decrease. Okay. However, and that's the last point on that, kind of like in the opening part of the conversation. To be in that position, a lot of the right decisions have to be made right now and between now and I'd say maybe June. And the reason for that is that on one hand, supplemental passes, Ukraine passed a mobilization law, begins to address the manpower deficit, building fortifications, people are making the right decisions. Then Ukraine's able to hold Russia to incremental gains this year at the peak of Russian defense spending. On the other hand, if the right calls aren't made in the coming months, the inertia will be very significant. And in the second half of the year, the risk of a Russian breakthrough really goes up, right? And these are kind of the two trajectories I see. And I want to be realistic about like the pessimistic scenario as well. And to be honest, the optimistic scenario is good, but it's not fantastic either, because you probably didn't hear me mention a third scenario where Ukraine can return to the offensive this year. And that's because I don't think it can. I don't think that's realistic at this point. I think we're well behind the timelines to achieve something like that this year.
I think that's, I mean, the point that you're making, or at least the point that I'm wanting to hear is like, I mean, is that the mood is dark now for good and right reasons.
Yep.
There is a more optimistic or more positive future, and which makes current actions and decisions in Washington and other European capitals so critical. I think that's something that we have generally lost sight of, is there is a more plausible scenario that we can tell, a story that we can tell about how Ukraine can be in a much better position come 2025, just as you have laid out. My question is, and it seems like step number 1, 2, and 3 is that the U.S. Congress has to pass the supplemental. But give us a sense about how consequential the supplemental will be. I think we generally understand it's not the silver bullet. It's not like supplemental passes and then all of a sudden we're on the right trajectory. But it's important. So talk to us about your assessment of what kind of impact the U.S. supplemental would have on current dynamics.
Yeah, it's a very important piece of the puzzle, but I want to get folks away from thinking that this is the sole solution. Basically, we pass the supplemental and that's all the problems are solved. They all go away. You know, once the supplemental is passed, Ukraine suddenly has an influx of men. Actually, a lot of the issues Ukraine has to solve on its own side, politically, militarily. The supplemental will provide funding to help us support their training efforts, their equip efforts, but there's quite a bit that they have to do. And there's quite a bit they have been doing. I think we have to give credit where it's due. Second, on the one hand, yes, supplemental passes, we probably could begin artillery ammunition deliveries within 2 weeks. So on the ammunition front, that's true. Although, folks should keep in mind, we are not that flush on ammunition this year, meaning we could help stabilize the situation, but it's not like the amount of ammo Ukraine receives is now going to change, you know, a 5 or 6 to 1 disadvantage to a 1 to 1 parity. It's actually still going to be a disadvantage. I want to make clear to it. The United States isn't sitting along with Europeans on so much ammo that once the supplemental passes, which is a night and day picture. Lastly, you know, when it comes to advanced equipment and capabilities, a lot of this has to be sorted out, coordinated with Ukrainians, and it's not clear what the United States, what Europeans are willing to provide. You know, let's say, for example, the request for fairly high end, the low availability air defense systems, things of that nature. So it'll take time to address these issues. Why I kept emphasizing, it's important to do these things now in the coming months, because if you fail to do them, the inertia of that inaction, the failure to make those decisions, casts a very big shadow over the course of the rest of the year, right? And this is often the hardest thing to convey to decision makers, that Look, you won't be able to fix this when you get to the real crisis point. You have to do it now to avoid the risk of some of these things months from now. And in fact, let's be honest, we are where we are today, Andrea, in the war because of decisions that were made and not made in the latter part of 2022. Like why there are ammunition, why certain things simply aren't there to enable another Ukraine offensive this year. It's not just ours. There's things that Ukrainians, I think, should have been doing last year, certainly last fall when it was clear that the offensive had failed, that they also weren't able to do. But if you just look at our own decision making, there's a whole host of things that we and particularly Europeans failed to do in the latter part of 2022 that kind of got us to where we are today.
Well, let me, first of all, Mike, it's great to have you back. Thanks so much for coming back. But let me go back to the supplemental. How long before we'll have to go after another supplemental? In other words, how long will this last, if you will? And what do you think the odds are that we'll get another supplemental? Of course, we got a presidential campaign coming up. It's congressional elections as well. We don't know the makeup of the Congress or the president. But when do we have a train wreck in terms of having to get another supplemental and running into politics on the Hill and the White House, for that matter?
Yeah. Okay. Really easy question, Jim. So first on supplemental. So I think that if it's passed, like I said, ammo deliveries can begin fairly quickly. Other things, it depends on the level of coordination we've had up to this point and the degree to which we have a common vision and we have things already in place that can sort of be switched on, like UCOM, SAGU, which works a lot of the security assistance for Ukraine under UCOM, and you know what's available in the pipeline from some of these material support coalitions that have been put together with Europeans on whether or not we can get another supplemental after this one, Jim. That is a very good question, and I am not a great DC politics insider, but I will tell you that I am skeptical that another large supplemental like this is likely to come after 2025. So this supplemental is going to have to carry us very far through 2024, well into 2025. Some things do depend on, of course, elections. Like we have elections because they matter. So it depends on who's in the White House. that's kind of a big... You know, I like to say things are contingent. Well, one of the things that's contingent in is the outcome of an election we're going to have in November. Yeah. One, it depends who's in the White House. Two, it depends on who holds which majorities in Congress. Right. Yeah. You're holding up two figures, right? Like two, there's Congress because the authorization for things like presidential drawdown authority come from Congress. They come from the legislative branch. Okay. People often forget that. So a number of these things come from the legislative branch. Depends who's in it, what the composition of that branch is. But in general, I hate to be a bit gloomy. I think Ukraine will get more assistance after this, but I am skeptical about the scale. We are talking about packages that are measured in the size of many billions of dollars. There, I begin to have doubts. And that's sort of almost independent of who wins the election. I'm not sure why I do, but these are kind of the signals I'm picking up in DC. What's your view? You're better at this than I am. Maybe you have like a different sense of the thing.
No, I'm with you on this. When you think out to 2025, not only are we going to have these political issues that you've very well outlined, but the requirements for the priorities and requirements for Ukraine are going to be they're going to be complex, because if they have F-16s by then, they're going to need money for munitions, spares, O&M. I mean, having F-16s, that's a whole nother requirement for assistance, and it's going to be tough. So their demands are going to become more complex. And secondly, if in fact by 2025, getting major packages out of the U.S., no matter where our politics drop next year, and and we can't seem to get a big package out of the United States, I'm not sure Europe is going to be at a point where they can fill the gap. And so that's kind of my follow-up. Where do you think Europe is by 2025? I mean, they're scrambling. We've seen them scrambling. But I mean, they're not going to be producing Patriot missiles, and they're not going to be producing AMRAAM or whatever the hell they're going to put on the F-16. So there's a lot of stuff that's unique to the U.S. and is expensive. So I think about 2025, and I worry about that because it's not going to be just 155 millimeter ammo. It's going to be more more expensive and more complex stuff that they're going to need. So what do you think about that?
Such a good question, just to underscore what you're saying, because I think what we hear, Jim, from a lot of allies is this optimism that if the U.S. could just pass this one supplemental, it will, you know, quote unquote, buy enough time for Europe to snap into gear and be able to pick up the slack. And I'm not sure that that's actually the case. So, I mean, for Mike, but also Jim, your sense of where that will be too, like, is this one package enough to buy enough time for Europe to get its act together and pick up the slack? Mike, what do you think?
I think on a number of issues, it is enough time. The question is, do they really get it and are they going to do it? Because the truth is that in this war, the United States spent a lot of ammunition, a lot of resources it had, thinking it was buying time for European production capacity to increase. And not all European countries, but some of the ones that had the most money and the most production capacity basically wasted that time. So first, on plans for sustainment and funding regarding F-16 transfer, boy, I hope Europeans sure have thought that through and they actually plan to sustain and fund those F-16s, because they would consume significant percentage of the Ukrainian defense budget. I've often in the background when having conversations about F-16, I've asked people, if you calculate based on number of F-16s you intend to transfer, if Ukraine had that number of F-16s, let's say at the start of the war, what percentage of Ukrainian defense spending do you think that would consume? Just like, you know, back of the envelope, rough calculations, because let me tell you, it would be a lot, all right? So somebody's going to have to fund that. Second, the U.S. has been very clear that Europe is a secondary theater, right? Russia is seen as an acute threat. I don't like that framing of it in the NDS because I think it's much more of a chronic and persistent threat, but fine. And it's good that the United States won't be able to have its dream, which is the ability to just focus on China and Indo-Pacific, because it's so much easier to have one adversary and competitor. And you can't just imagine a landscape where you don't have more than one, because we do. But if Europeans are going to work this year hard to try to Trump-proof a lot of assistance to Ukraine, which they are, they're trying to shift them more into like a NATO umbrella, you know, if you want to do things like try to proof something, looking at the potential outcome of the U.S. election, then you're going to have to be the one funding and supporting that, right? Like, the only way to prove something is to be the one that's paying for it. And that's the truth. If you want to Trump prove something, then you should be the one that's paying for it, and you should be the one that's doing most of the lifting behind that effort. By the way, since this war is a principal factor affecting European security and future European security architecture, you'd expect that kind of investment, yeah? Like, we're obviously a power in Europe too and very vested in it, but we can't possibly be much more vested in it than actual European countries. And I'm not saying it's to take credit away from anything that Europeans have done, but saying moving forward, right? Europe also, by the way, at base level has a much higher production capacity and output on things like artillery and munitions. So then you wonder how we got to a place where the US was supplying the overwhelming majority of artillery ammo, because we had in stock relative to Europe, even though Europe-based production capacity on the continent of Europe, when you look at major manufacturers, Rheinmetall, like BOT-EXPAL, they didn't expand things, but they have pretty large capacity when you look across the country. Quite a bit of the ammo they make, they don't actually make for Ukraine. Also, just putting that out there. So basically, the reason I'm saying is that Europe actually does have the production capacity to increasingly sustain Ukraine's artillery ammunition demand. And demand a number of categories, not everything. We can sustain long-term supply of Gimlers to HIMARS. We can sustain a supply of ammunition to Patriot batteries, although not a high rate. If you look at the numbers, I think we, in one type of missile, we make somewhere up to 600. Another type of missile, we make up to 300 per year, which isn't a lot, right?
No,
it ain't. But look, the story I'm trying to tell here is that in many cases, yes, Europe does have the capacity. If they invest in multi-year contracts, they can put things on a more sustainable footing. They are not out of equipment, although they're low in some categories, but on older equipment, we actually have quite a bit too that we can send that I don't think we need, that we have in storage and reserves. So a lot of this is doable. I won't say it's doable without the United States, but it is much more practicable for Europe to take over a significant share of the burden within the next year, year and a half, which is the potential timeline of the next supplemental, if they are serious about it and if they do not waste this time. But those are pretty big ifs in my experience. And I'll say something else that hopefully won't get me into too much trouble. Across the board, it has not been just the United States, not by a long shot. But often when Europeans say, hey, America, it's not just going to be you, I like immediately get worried because usually it means that it's still mostly going to be us. And I think that they need to look to a future where it down the line, it may be mostly us on intelligence and on key capabilities, but in a lot of other categories, it mostly is going to be them and it mostly should be them.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And my concern is there's a lot of wheel spinning going on right now and still not contracts out there. So your point about if they're acting, you know, with intent and with speed to meet a year, year and a half timeline, then maybe we'll be okay. But my fear is that there's a lot of smoke, but not a lot of fire right now. And I haven't seen anything that makes me think that they're beginning to get their act together along those lines. So I think it's still up in the air whether they can deliver what will be needed within a year, year and a half time frame. Other than 155, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, other kinds of munitions that are that aren't manufactured, you know, at scale, you know, then I think they'll do okay with 155, but others, it's going to be dribbles.
Just that, look, there's a lot Europe can do if they want to have more in-country presence on maintenance, on training, if they want to expand training in Europe for Ukrainian forces, if they want to work on sustainment, there's quite a bit they can do. There's still countries in Europe that have equipment they can provide. In general, the kind of the way I look at it is that, if you look at European forces, no military wants to give up capability it has, right? No military wants to surrender capability they have, particularly in active stocks. However, the United States has another strategic adversary in another theater that is a principal adversary and competitor for the United States, okay? Who is Europe's other principal adversary or competitor? Who is this equipment for in Europe? Like, who else does Europe actually plan to fight? What's all this stuff for, okay?
That's right.
Is there another war? This is a large-scale conventional war in Europe. Is there another war? Because this one will do until the next one gets here, right? Like, who is the stuff being saved for? And unlike the United States, the trade-offs that Europeans have to make aren't nearly as significant strategically and aren't nearly as big a concern as they could potentially be for us. Just being frank about it, is there some other adversary that Europeans plan to fight? You'll need all the stuff to deal with migrant issues from the Mediterranean. Sorry, like, just being very direct on this. Yeah, so if you have high-end equipment, I understand you don't want to take it out of the force. On the one hand, that's true. On the other hand, is there another fight that's going to be larger than this fight with Russia where there's a better way to attrit Russian forces than now?
Yeah, it's a good point. Sorry, I had this looming question from earlier in the conversation, last question on the supplemental, which is like its relationship to Ukraine's manpower issue. So is there, like, how are those two things in your mind related? Obviously, if Ukraine is able to recruit new forces, mobilize new forces, if they don't have the stuff to equip them with, then it doesn't do as much good. And or I don't know if the lack of equipment and sense that the U.S. isn't there to support them is dampening people's willingness to fight. I don't know. So talk to me a little bit about how you see the relationship between those two issues, understanding still that manpower is really a central thing.
Yeah, I think mobilization is a pretty thorny and complex issue. So first, on equipment, Ukraine's main problem is infantry, and you don't need much in the way of equipment at all for infantry. Okay, making infantry battalions is probably the easiest thing from an equipment standpoint. And you don't need super advanced high-end equipment either to form infantry units. Ukraine in general has had a pretty odd approach to force structure, making new brigades when they can't equip or actually man the brigades they have. Converting brigades by name. Increasingly, the force is sort of consuming what manpower does have for lack of an alternative. So the regular military has been steadily integrating the territorial defense units and renaming territorial defense brigades as mechanized brigades or naval infantry brigades, even though they neither have that equipment nor that specialization. And so I would say that the biggest impact of the supplemental is we need money, ideally funding, to sustain and expand training, both here, both in Europe and in Ukraine. In order for Ukraine to conduct a rotation, it needs to have an expanded force structure because you need brigades on hand to rotate other brigades off the front. Otherwise, the force faces depletion and exhaustion, which has been the case for the last 6 months. I think that there's a lot that Ukraine has to sort out on its own and with regard to manpower, meaning process-wise, what actually happens with these folks, how they're mobilized, what training is provided, because a lot of time units get better training the first couple of days of a brigade than they get in basic, and what part needs to be offloaded. I won't say offloaded, but what part can effectively be displaced onto Western countries, because if you're going to mobilize at a significantly higher rate than you have been, you're going to have real throughput issues in terms of growth, right? Like, say you were mobilizing X people last month, and this month you have to mobilize 3X, right? So you need to be able to count on Western countries to pick up some of this. Lastly, I don't know, you know, I'm not going to dissect kind of what Ukrainians think in polls, but I would say for me at the top of the list is a public perception that mobilization can't be a one-way ticket, right? And the sense that if you go into the military, you have a way off the front lines, you'll be rotated at some point rather than fight on the front for the next several years till you're killed or wounded in action, that you way have a way out of the military potentially too. Also that there's a vision and there's, you know, this is pretty basic, but there's a likelihood of success. And it's not specific to having equipment. It's specific to understanding at the base level, which I think everybody does, everybody in Ukraine does. And here I'm not speaking for Ukrainians. I'm just speaking as someone who spent a lot of time on the front lines. That if your war effort depends significantly on material support from the United States, the United States is either with you or it's not, right? Western countries are either with you or they're not. And it's not going to reveal itself in the specific number of armored fighting vehicles or Patriot batteries sent. It's going to reveal itself in the fact that the United States clearly shows that it's still in this war, right, and believes in some kind of success in this war, or it isn't. And the supplemental by itself is a very, very large indicator, right, of what you look for. Because if you pass it, then at least Ukrainians understand that they're not being abandoned by the West, which told them it wouldn't abandon them before for the last several months. Like in practice, I won't say abandoning them, but in practice, it's very hard to describe what we've been doing since September at from a military assistance and support effort as a good practice vis-a-vis allies. I don't know how Jim would characterize it. I won't say abandonment, that's too far, but when you're in the middle of a large-scale conventional war, I certainly won't point to it as like a case study for what success looks like.
Let me ask something. Get your feel on this, and you and Andrea for you as well. Do you all get the feeling that that this is becoming or on its way to being the forgotten war? And I say that because you hear this popping up now in op-eds and that type of thing, because it's being compared to Gaza. And Gaza's going to be around a long time. Iran, Israel is going to be around for a long time. It's capturing headlines. It is capturing the attention of world leaders, particularly in Washington on the NSC. It's becoming political big time in the United States. It's just taking all the oxygen out of the room. And some people are saying, you know, Ukraine was yesterday's headline. It is quickly becoming the forgotten war within the Beltway in Washington. Would you agree with that? Or is that where we are going? And if you think that that's kind of what it feels like, how do you combat that? Because it gets to your point about the guys on the front lines. If they get the sense that the U.S. has gone on to other things, that's going to be awful in terms of morale, et cetera, et cetera. So what are your feelings on that?
That's an interesting question, Jim. So on the one hand, I think forgotten war is overstating the case. And and I'll be frank, I'm probably not the best person to ask because I follow this war professionally and have since well before the war started. For me, this has consumed the better part of my professional life over the last 2.5 years. So for me, it's very much not forgotten. But the question is, what is it like for anybody else or any normal person that's sort of tracking the news? I think media is certainly part of the issue and part of the problem because media goes to where the action is. And if there's a new war and things are happening there, media is obviously going to shift coverage, right? I don't think that this war has kind of ended up where Afghanistan ended up in the 2000s. Remember Afghanistan quickly moved off the front page and then it got shunted. You had to like flip through the paper quite a bit before you got to whatever's going on in Afghanistan. So I won't say that it's at Afghanistan level of coverage, certainly, but what's interesting is that, of course, in terms of bandwidth and government effort, yeah, in some points, I'm sure it's taken second place to the situation between Israel and Gaza. The people who make decisions, as you know, have the same 24 hours in a day as everybody else, right? So there's only so much bandwidth government has to deal with so many crises at the same time, right? That's just the reality. One thing I use whenever I talk to anybody who's in government is I have a look at what maps they have on their wall to get a sense of a little bit like what's going on with their attention span. And you can definitely see the space shared by, I think, maps of Ukraine with maps of Israel and Gaza after October competing for that space. You know, this is a very terrible indicator of things, but nonetheless, it was visible. It was visible, I think, in offices across D.C. as people were rapidly familiarizing themselves with the geography of Israel. So I think that certainly it's had to share that space and compete for bandwidth. I don't think it's forgotten, but I think that the proposition inherently leads people to make decisions on what they can do to stay in the news, to keep themselves from being forgotten. And this has always been one element of Ukrainian political strategies to what they can do to sustain Western attention because they are so dependent on external Western material support in terms of their fortunes in this war. I don't think that this war is forgotten in government. I do feel sometimes it's forgotten in media. In fact, I remember a month or two after the Gaza war when talking to some of my colleagues in journalistic circles, and they'd reach out jokingly and saying like, hey, aren't you that analyst from, you know, that war from a while ago since all the coverage moved to Israel? And I would say, oh yeah, remember me? I mean, on the way, I'll be frank. I probably secretly dreamed that some attention would be reduced on this war in the media just because you get way too many folks asking and you feel pressed to help them out. But on the other hand, yeah, attention shifted very fast. It did. I definitely got that impression. And I think it's been balanced now. I think it's probably rebalancing a bit. But it all depends in some respect what happens in Israel and Gaza. You know, the only positive thing, I'll be naughty here, that all the people who rapidly emerge as experts on Russia and Ukraine and Russia-Ukraine military, quite a few of them seem to have moved on to become experts on the Middle East and Israel and Hamas and Hezbollah, you know. And I wish the best of luck to the people who are actually experts in those fields.
My just really a quick two cents is, I mean, I think that there is a general understanding of the stakes of what's happening in Ukraine. I mean, at least in some parts of government. And I think, you know, we Mike and I have written about this and talked about this, about the yo-yoing kind of perceptions in Washington, D.C. about the nature of the Russian threat and how significant it is. And I think what we have to be realistic about is that Russia is preparing itself for a long-term confrontation with the West. It's not just about Ukraine, but it's this broader confrontation. And you just look at all the changes in the way that Putin is reshaping Russian society, the way that they've put the economy on a wartime footing, the way that they're really cultivating deeper ties with Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. Like, they're in this for the long haul. And for us to kind of lose interest now would be a colossal mistake. And when you think about kind of the shifting geopolitics in the aftermath of the invasion, and in particular, the coalescence of Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, just what the geopolitical landscape looks like. To me, like, addressing these larger challenges run through Ukraine. And if we don't get that right, we're going to have a world of larger problems than we had before. So I, you know, in terms of how do you counter maybe some of the malaise or disinterest in the war, I think you have to keep reminding people about the stakes. But Mike, my question is, you know, we've talked about that, you know, Russia might have a window of opportunity. Again, the West has the opportunity to make a series of good decisions that could turn the tide, at least from where we are today, in a more positive trajectory for Ukraine. And Russia understands that, and it sees this window of opportunity. If everything goes right in the West and Ukraine is able to reapply pressure in 2025 or so, how long do you think Russia can sustain this? And I was just reading an article by Alexandra Prokopenko on like the economy and how sustainable is it? And I'm going to actually, because this really grabbed my attention. She had a sentence or a few sentences. She says, in a best case scenario, the current arrangement will likely to come apart within 18 months owing to growing imbalances and possible social problems. Putin will face increased pressures from a policy trilemma resulting from the challenge of continuing to fund the war, sustaining standards of living, and guaranteeing macroeconomic stability. So I guess it's a long way of saying, if we can get through this very difficult period in 2024, what do you think the outlook is for Russia in 2025 and beyond?
Okay. So my own view is I think Russia can sustain this through 2025. And I think that really the decisive period of the war at this point, even though every year of a war is decisive, is very much what happens this year. I hope Ukraine will be in a position to retake the initiative and apply pressure next year. I'm not sure, looking at where we've ended up with timelines and how far in the hole we are in some things, that we'll be able to get there. I think the most important thing is that Russia is not in a position to attain a decisive advantage this year, and that Russian leverage and Russia's relative negotiating position it deteriorates significantly compared to where we are right now. That is to say that the hand that Russia has to play in Russia's likelihood of attaining their objectives in the war, this likelihood decreases very significantly when we get earlier into 2025. On structural economic pressures, well, I'm a bit skeptical on social problems. I think that's kind of like abstract and out there. I don't disagree in general with Sasha Prokopenko's analysis. I think it's quite good. Also, she's a colleague at Carnegie Berlin. I would add that I think overall it is true that Russia has some structural economic imbalances that make it quite difficult to manage to sustain. Partly is because the Russian state is competing for skilled labor within the defense sector and contracting manpower for the war. And this has a negative effect in their ability to manage inflation because they're spending revenue from energy exports, and they're spending it in a way that in some ways drives inflation. So they're going to have to address it. The economy is, and I probably leave this to folks who are much more focused on Russian economy or genuine economists. But not only does it seem to be operating at max potential with quite low unemployment, but it also appears to be overheating. And so the Russian state had taken off a number of safeguards on macroeconomic stability in order to sustain this, which we know long-term is a bad idea. The problem, I would say, is that when we say long-term, we're looking maybe a couple of years out, but those couple of years are not what's going to decide this war, given where we are at this point. So we're much more in a conversation here about 12 to 18 months. And I think that those are big issues from an economic standpoint that Russia will have to deal with. But I don't know if they're going to substantially affect the course of this war in such a short timeline. Which is to say, yes, there are problems. I'm not sure that they're the things that are going to most affect Russian sustainability of the war right now. So I don't think people should sit back and say, oh, like the Russian economy will just force them to kind of stop the war. I think it's very important that the Russian military effort is stopped this year. Like, that would be very direct of what I'm saying. And if it is, then the likelihood of a major Russian breakthrough in general and that Russia can achieve its war aims goes down significantly next year. And that's the part we need to get to, yeah? And losing interest. You know what, well, I see the issue from my point of view is less interest. I've just noticed a significant drift in policy. I've noticed way too much routinization of military support for Ukraine, of the process itself, bureaucratically, and far too much adrift. And I've seen it in some areas of our decision-making in the U.S. government. I wonder if part of that is because we're nearing the end of the first term of administration. And so there is, you know, some expected personnel turnover and there's some degree of malaise. But I am very worried, as somebody focused on this war, when I see drift, and I see drift for quite a few months in strategy, and I'm not hearing, I would say, the best or vociferously articulated vision of the way forward. Some folks might think that that's a bit unfair. Fine, but let me actually turn this back to you and Jim. Maybe I'm wrong, Jim. Maybe you have heard these things. Maybe you sense that, you know, there isn't a drift, and you know this town quite well. Maybe you have a different impression.
No, I have exactly that impression. You know, and again, it goes back to your point about there's only 24 hours in the day for everyone. And Gaza, Iran, Israel has turned into an incredible time zone. And the potential for disaster coming out of that part of the world is pretty high. So I think it's almost a natural course where there's a drift going on, also propelled by the fact that there's disappointment about the offensive. There is personality conflicts probably between some Ukrainian leadership and U.S. leadership, you know, Jake Sullivan and his counterpart, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of forces at play. Malaise is a good descriptive as well. And now we're going to start paying more attention to the presidential politics too. So I think there is a drift caused by a number of different reasons. And there has not been anything coming out of the administration in a long time that I would consider something new and a new perspective, a new angle of attack. It's been the same talking points if they talk about Ukraine at all. So I agree with you 100%.
To try to break the malaise, though, I mean, Mike, you've just laid it out in really clear and stark terms. So there's a more positive path, albeit it's still a difficult path and, you know, a long way to go to something that we would consider success. But then we haven't talked as much about the alternative. So we've talked about the potential that Russia could make more significant gains, maybe late summer, early fall. But what does that actually look like? I mean, I think that's the hard thing. And I know we can't know for sure, but, you know, are we talking about significant territorial gains? Are they going to, what? Tell me in your assessment about what we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. So first, with the necessary caveats, as always, my line of work is not fortune telling. So it's very, very hard to say in a conventional war, okay, here's exactly what these things could look like, but it's important to frame the discussion. The Russian military clearly is trying to break through key transit hubs in major cities in Donetsk and take the rest of the Donbass. That's fairly delineated to the cities of Pokrovsk, Kramatorsk, Slavyansk. They've been slowly creeping towards some of them, and there's key battles still playing out right now. One that started over Chasiv Yar, west of Bakhmut. Another one is Russian slow creeping advance from the salient they took at Avdiivka towards the main roads, ground lines of communication coming out of Pokrovsk. They're about 20 miles from Pokrovsk at this point. So the Russian aim and ambition, the Russian military strategy, is very clear. It's not something we have to guess at. It's actually been the same one for the last 2 years, to be perfectly honest. If you look at the Russian ground force campaign, it's not this one area where I will eliminate the uncertainty. I think we know very clearly what it is. Second, despite a lot of kind of gesturing and posturing that they might want to take Kharkiv, I don't think they have the capacity to do that. And I think a lot of that's kind of a distraction to fix Ukrainian defensive efforts. And for coercive purposes as well, I don't think that that's very much in the offing. And if it was, you would only be the Ukrainian military so weakened in the second half, much later in this year. And even then, the amount of forces required, you can always look for good indicators. And Russia would only be in a position to do that if they were able to take Kupiansk and cross the river further southeast of the city. So you can look for some markers to see if they're even remotely in a position to enact this kind of campaign. And I am skeptical of it. So worst case scenario, the breakthroughs, and I want to be clear, I obviously think that any more territory or any more cities Ukraine loses is terrible on the one hand. On the other hand, if Russia still advances and is able to break through and take the rest of Donetsk relative to what they currently occupy, it's still not kind of a make it or break it for Ukraine in terms of economic viability or future ability to sustain defensive efforts. Meaning, I don't see Russia being in a position to make tremendous territorial gains, the kind that would really jeopardize Ukraine's viability as a state. Hope that makes sense. I'm deeply skeptical that there could be a cascade collapse of the Ukrainian defensive effort. I'm also very skeptical of that score. This is both because the interaction of sort of stability of Ukrainian forces and Russian struggles to employ forces of scale and sustain momentum, which you would need to do in order to engender a collapse, right? It's not about having, one successful operation. It's about being actually able to sustain a breakthrough. So with all that in mind, I think that the worst case scenario to me isn't that terrible, but we're focusing here on the ground campaign, the front line. What we're not talking enough about is the critical infrastructure strike campaign that began over the past month, which is doing significant damage to Ukrainian electricity grid, power generation capacity. And to the extent that the progress on the front line, I think is fairly slow or incremental, you're going to see a lot of fighting displaced into larger scale strike campaigns. You saw the Ukrainian strike campaign against Russian fuel refining capacity, right, that took off in February, that was paused for a bit, then came back with a vengeance in March. Russian campaign against Ukraine's electricity grid. These are the things I would look to that down the line, later this year or after this year, will be more deterministic of relative leverage in the war. So I don't exclude those, and we shouldn't sort of be myopically focused on what's happening along the line of control, because yeah, it matters where it is, but let's be very blunt. If it shifts a couple kilometers one direction or another, that's not the center of gravity in this war, and that's not going to be strategically deterministic of outcomes in this war either.
I mean, you do hear some, I mean, at least on Russian talk shows or other things, kind of these statements about making Ukraine uninhabitable and other things. And so there's other things that Russia can do to basically undermine its viability. Yeah. I mean, does that underscore, I mean, is that why the air defense piece is so important? I mean, if this is the path that Russia is going down, if they can't actually break through on the front lines and they're going to start pursuing some of these other lines of attack to try to undermine Ukraine in other ways, then is that just upping the importance of air defense so they're not having to make these calculations about which cities they can actually defend?
The air and missile defense piece is very important. No, I don't think Ukraine will get to a place where it doesn't have to make these calculations. Ukraine is the largest country in Europe outside of Russia. Ukraine does not have enough air defense to defend all the major cities and critical infrastructure and a 1,000-kilometer front line and a large border with Russia. Okay, this is just not in the cards. Some of the strike capabilities that Russia's employing, like drones, have very cheap solutions to them, like mobile air defense, gun-based air defense, which is responsible for a lot of the intercepts. We definitely have more air defense we can provide, and we can improve that picture over time. But air defense has been a consistent treadmill, one of the two main treadmills we've been running on throughout this war alongside artillery. Okay, that's why we've always talked about them together as separate issues, but issues that have to be constantly managed. Increasingly, Ukrainian ability to defend and efficiency of Ukrainian defense has improved. On the other hand, Russian targeting and the Russian production of missiles and drones has also increased. And Russian dynamic targeting beyond the front line has gotten quite a bit better over the last 6 to 8 months, observably so. So
potentially with Chinese help on satellite imaging, I'm just highlighting the more warnings about coming out of the U.S. intelligence community about what China is doing for Russia.
Yeah, I think you and I and Jim both. China has been in many different ways the largest enabler of Russia's war effort, although maybe in discrete categories, North Korea and Iran have contributed ammunition, drones, missiles, the discrete finished military goods. But overall, I think if we replay the footage of this war and look at who enabled Russia's war, military effort the most in fundamental categories like components, resources, various other forms of support, we're probably going to find it's China. So
it's the big winner.
Well, yeah, I don't know if they're the winner, but I definitely think that I think I'm not sure how well this was priced in early on. Does that make any sense? I'm not sure how well Chinese, Iranian, North Korean support was well priced in into our effort, and to some degree a slow increase or mobilization of our own defense efforts. Yeah,
well, I agree, and I think a lot of people were looking on what that would look like in terms of Chinese assistance to Russia, that it would look like Chinese tanks and Chinese aircraft and Chinese small arms and things that you could see on TV being shipped to Russia. That's what people were so afraid of. That's what the Chinese are going to do. But they were much more insidious. It's the components. It's the chips. It's this and that that can go through a third country very easily, never be seen. And it looks like China's not doing anything to support the Russians. You know, you don't see these pictures of Chinese, you know, aircraft, but in fact, it's a steady stream that enables Russia to do it itself domestically. And that is, you're right, that has been a lifeline to the Russians.
I'll put in a teaser that we've got Richard Fontaine and I, a piece coming out next week. We're calling it The Axis of Upheaval, looking at China, Iran, North Korea. So that might have you back for that conversation as well, because I know you're largely in agreement with what's going on and the implications. But I think we're at time. Oh, go ahead, Mike. You can do it.
Yeah, just one tiny two-finger on this, Jim. One thing that I think folks may not pay enough attention to is that sanctions and export controls and the loss of Western markets had led Chinese goods in a host of categories, from cars on the market to trucks to other things, to replace Western goods in Russia. But it essentially gave a very significant lifeline to the Russian economy, right? From de-dollarized payments to key goods for commercial purposes, replacing things that Russia depended on from the West. And that, you may say, well, what does that have to do with the war effort? Well, it allowed the state to continue over the last 2 years without having the economy being completely on fire, actually being able to focus on things like defense industrial production. And with the central bank and financial parts of the Russian bureaucracy being able to essentially stabilize the economy and the financial system, and China filling in for loss of access to key goods. So we're sort of focused on the military and the component side. We're not seeing this large part of what actually takes for an economy to function and where a lot of things to Russia came from. And if you look at like why is Russia kind of, you know, has these long-term imbalances and whatnot, but how's it gone this long over the last 2+ years to begin with? China is one part of that answer. Sorry, I just wanted to get that in to basically to say it's much bigger
than part of the answer. Yeah. And including some European goods being re-exported on through Central Asia, et cetera, et cetera. So definitely like a whole nother conversation we can have about why Russia is a persistent problem. Well, this has been really great. I always struggle at the end of these conversations. Like, I just wish that we had a more positive way to wrap things up or something more, I don't know, hopeful or constructive for how to move forward, but they're just hard conversations to have, and just really appreciate, as always, all of your expertise and insight. And we're so glad that you were back with us for the discussion. So thanks, Mike.
Yeah. So it was great to be back.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Brussels Sprouts, brought to you by the Transatlantic Security Team at the Center for a New American Security. You can find all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And please remember to rate and review Brussels Sprouts so that new listeners are able to find the show.